Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news. Stand by now for the World View. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview. Welcome back to the show where we don't take calls. We don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. So good to have you with us. As we begin, I want to discuss, well, a couple of, you could call them parenting issues, but I hate the word parenting. Hate that word. Child-rearing principles. I was discussing with a friend of mine at church this morning. A friend of mine is a grandfather who has come into possession of his granddaughters, and he's raising them. And he commented on how hard it is to get the little ones under control from time to time. If you're a parent, you know what I'm talking about. And I asked him if he had tried any of the training methods to be found in the book called To Train Up a Child that my wife and I have used for years in the raising of our children. And he said, yeah, well, yes, I have tried those, but man, it's hard to get them to stick. And I told him I've found that if the training methods in the book aren't working, you probably aren't hitting the kids hard enough. And I realize in retrospect that I left something out. Because my wife and I discussed this on the way home, and she pointed out that it's really consistency that's the hardest part. It's not the corporal punishment of the child, difficult as that may be. It's the consistency of the training that is the hard part. And so when I see my good friend next week, I'll mention to him that consistency is the hardest part. And hopefully we can help each other. And, God bless him for doing what's right by his grandkids. That's for sure. I want to talk a little bit about corporal punishment. Had to explain corporal punishment to my 9-year-old daughter. She asked me, what does corporal punishment mean? And I said, well, corporal comes from the, I don't know if it's Latin or Greek, but your body is your corpus. And so corporal punishment is punishment on your body. And she said, you mean like a spanking? I said, that's exactly what I mean by corporal punishment. But I pointed out that she had given me a lesson in corporal punishment. She had proven to me the old axiom that corporal punishment works. And she did it without even trying. See, my 9-year-old, she's a bit acrobatic in her day-to-day life. And so lately, she has abandoned her traditional method for coming down the stairs. Her traditional method is to slide down the banister. But she's abandoned that in favor of her new method, which is to walk out on the mezzanine, I guess you'd call it, portion above our living room. She climbs over the banister onto the roof of the pantry, from which she then hangs down off the edge of the pantry and drops about 3.5-4 feet to the floor. So that's her favorite mode of coming downstairs lately. And I know some of you parents out there might think that I need to get control of my kids, but frankly, if I could slide down the banister and if I could jump off the pantry, I'd do it myself. And so I don't begrudge the children their acrobatic youth, and I'm willing to tolerate an awful lot in that regard. Besides, it helps me relive my youth when I see my 9-year-old flying off the pantry into the living room. But what was I talking? I was talking about corporal punishment. Corporal punishment works, and my 9-year-old daughter Nicole proved it because she's been engaging in this leap from the roof of the pantry for several days. And at one point, she dropped off the pantry without really looking. She was getting a little careless about what she was doing. She dropped off the pantry hanging from her little fingertips. She dropped off without looking. And the edge of the trim at the top of the pantry door, which is very sharp, it caught her right on the hip and put a good-sized divot in her hip, and it hurt. and she cried and went through the whole thing. And I've noticed now, whenever she hangs from the pantry, before she drops, she takes a real good look at how she's aligned with that trim before she drops down to the floor. And I asked her, I said, you know, before you hurt yourself, did you ever even look at that trim? She said, not really. I said, do you look at it every time now? And she laughed and she said, yeah, I do. I look at it every time now. So corporal punishment works. Even when you're not even trying, corporal punishment is effective. All right, now how did I get off on that? I don't know why I decided to start there, but that's where we've started. Now, if you want to move to the news, if you don't want to move to the news, I could just talk about my kids all day. In fact, I'm going to bring up another topic that came up between myself and my 9-year-old genius daughter. But that'll be for later in the broadcast, I do believe. Let's go to the news. We have some shocking news for everyone out there. I hope you're sitting down. This is from Newsmax. Kathleen Parker has decided to leave the Parker Spitzer primetime program on CNN. That's according to the CNN network, which has announced that it's retooling the show around Elliot Spitzer. I know everyone in the audience is like, who is Kathleen Parker? And Elliot Spitzer, is he? I thought he was still in jail, for crying out loud. But apparently, Kathleen Parker has decided to leave the show, and a new show will take its place. If you're at your DVR, you can set it right now. This new show will be called In the Arena, and it will use an ensemble format with several newsmakers, guests, and contributors joining the aforementioned Elliot Spitzer on weekdays there on CNN, proving another old axiom that there's hardly a person on the planet who can hold down a half hour of broadcast time on their own, and Elliot Spitzer is not one of them. He's going to have to bring in more sidekicks than Sean Hannity to try to scratch and claw his way through a half hour of television. Is it a half hour show or is it an hour show? Can you go check the DVR? I have not watched the, what's it called? The Parker Spitzer broadcast. I can claim ignorance here. I've never watched not even one second of it, to be honest with you. And something about Elliot Spitzer just gives me the creeps. I mean, is it just me? Or if you see Elliot Spitzer on television for even a brief moment, don't you feel like you need a course of Valtrex? Is that just me? Or I don't know. Something about the guy gives me the creeps, and so I haven't watched. But Spitzer can't carry off a half hour of broadcast television by himself. Well, I could do it in my sleep, but these liberals, they wouldn't be able to tolerate me on their air over there at CNN, and I'm not sure I would survive very long in that particular...
He might have a hook or something.
What's that now? Elliot? He might have what now?
Hookers.
Oh, I think we have something on that a little later in the broadcast as well. I don't know if it involves Spitzer or not, but... Well, let's move on to other earth-shattering news. This is from NBC in Washington, D.C. Diana Waterman, the newly elected first vice chairman of the Maryland State Republican Party, has a black Angus cow named Oprah. Yeah. According to the Baltimore Sun, the issue came to light in a recent Facebook posting when Oprah gave birth to a calf. And by that I meant the black Angus cow. Oprah gave birth to a calf. Of course, that wouldn't make sense any other way. This Republican Party hack, Waterman, she's been criticized for naming the cow after the African-American talk show host who has struggled with her weight. And a liberal blogger, he says that's, quote, precisely why an enormous number of Americans view Republicans as racist, unquote. Well, if the Republican vice chairman was making fun of Oprah because of her weight, how is that racist? Oh, it's a black Angus. Ah, well, there you have the racist angle. See, I would have missed that, but I've got my racism antenna is now finally attuned, and now I get it. Anyway, so Oprah gave birth to a calf. I really only did that story so I could say that line. Oprah gave birth to a calf. No, Oprah's never given birth to anything, I don't believe. Nothing good anyways. Let's see here. Let's move on into the culture file. From the Reuters Wire, a married father of two has been ordained as a priest by the Catholic Church in Germany. That's right. It happened last week after receiving an exemption to priestly celibacy directly from Pope Benedict XVI himself. The gentleman's name is Harm Kluting, and he's a theologian and former Protestant pastor who will not have to adhere to the church's celibacy laws for the duration of his marriage, is how the rule reads, which is kind of odd. So I guess if this marriage doesn't work out, he has to go celibate. Or I don't know what they're implying here. Anyway, he's gotten over on the Catholic hierarchy. He's a priest, and he gets to keep his wife. Oh, all right. Last year, a married father of four was ordained as a priest in Regensburg in southern Germany. And Kluting's ordination comes as theologians and Catholic politicians in Germany have pressured the Vatican to end priestly celibacy. And the German church struggles to overcome a wave of those unfortunate clerical sex abuse scandals and the ensuing priest shortage that has gripped the Catholic Church in Germany. The Roman Catholic Church also launched its first ordinariate for disaffected Anglicans in England and Wales this year, so there could be more married priests flooding in to the Catholic Church there in Germany with these disaffected Anglicans who are apparently been disaffected. Their disaffection has been prompted by traditionalist opposition to the Church of England's plans to ordain women bishops and to allow gay clergy and same-sex blessings, whatever that is. I'm not sure what a same-sex blessing is, but I guess that's one of the advantages of not being involved in organized religion as it seeks a path to the bottom. Anyway, I just thought that was neat. I've always wondered, why is it that the Catholic Church has this insane policy of not allowing their priests to get married and then cooping them all up in a rectory all day? I mean, that's bound to lead to problems. Anyway, I believe it's from the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages, back when the church was consolidating land and political power. And one of the ways the church decided to control all that was to not allow the priests to marry into ruling families, which apparently they were wont to do back then. But, you know, move it into the 21st century. Move it into the 18th century, I say to the Catholic Church. And I have a lot of good friends who are Catholics who are involved in the pro-life movement, so I'm always interested in the goings-on within the Catholic Church. And it's a good sign that they're going to let this priest remain married, and perhaps it will start a trend. And little boys will be able to go to confession again, and they won't have to look over their shoulder. All right. Enough of the religious news. Well, let's move now to the economics subfile out of the culture file from Washington, D.C., the Associated Press. Global food prices are rising, and more corn being diverted to the production of ethanol fuel has Bill Clinton worried. Clinton stood up this past week, and he's given us a warning of food riots in poor nations. He gave us this warning about 2 weeks after all the food riots broke out in all the poor nations. You know, like Egypt and the like, you know, the whole gambit. Anyway, Bill, as usual, he's on top of his game. The former president, according to the Associated Press, told Farmers and Agriculture Department employees last Thursday that while producing biofuels is important for reducing America's dependence on foreign oil, farmers should also look beyond domestic production and consider the needs of developing countries. At which point, everyone in the audience just looked at him stunned and said, "Do you even know what you're talking about, Bill?" I mean, he was one of the biggest cheerleaders for ethanol back in the 90s. Not that they all haven't been cheerleaders. Republicans and Democrats alike have been encouraging us to burn our food for fuel. Someone needs to let them know that, you know, that's what they do in Haiti. We don't need to be burning our food for fuel. We need to be seeking out new and robust sources of crude oil is what we need to be doing. But I'm not sure Bill's on board for that. By the way, according to this article, this is shocking to me. 37% of all U.S. corn production could be used for ethanol by what, the end of your lifetime? No, by next year. Nearly 40% of our corn is being burned up as fuel. That just doesn't seem, that doesn't seem right to me. But then again, I'm no scientist, and I've never been convinced in the idea of a perpetual motion machine, and I've never been convinced that you can burn food for oil. But according to this article, after years of subsidizing ethanol production, Congress has taken an increasingly skeptical look at the fuel as food prices have fluctuated and cutting spending has become a legislative priority. So they built the monster. They created this enormous problem that's leading to increased food inflation and food riots and perhaps destabilizing the entire world. And now they're finally ready to take an increasingly skeptical look, which I think what that means in Congress is we'll create a few more patronage jobs for our cousins and our nephews and have them look into this problem, and perhaps we will come up with a solution. We care a lot. It's the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. And be careful of people who act like they care about you. That's my advice. Now let's go deeper into the culture file. Berkeley, California. This is from, where is this? This is from the Associated Press, the esteemed Associated Press from Berkeley. Even as fears of criminal crackdowns fade, the flagship pot dispensaries in each of California's two biggest medical marijuana cities are facing tax troubles that could cost them millions of dollars. That's right, Berkeley and Oakland, the dispensaries there. What's the name of this one? Oh, this is cute. Berkeley Patients Group. You know, you'd think you'd be going there for some physical therapy, you know, to have your stitches taken out, but no, it's to get a ball. Anyway, it's called, Berkeley Patients Group. Anyway, these dispensaries, two of the flagship dispensaries in the flagship pothead cities, their difficulties, according to the AP, stem from the legal haze that still surrounds the drug out there in California. Where, by the way, medical marijuana has been legal for 15 years. So the case against these dispensaries is a tax case. And the AP tells us that it highlights the huge sums of money moving through the state's medical marijuana operations. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in state tax documents, Berkeley Patients Group reported selling more than $51 million worth of medical marijuana between 04 and 07. The dispensary claimed it did not need to pay sales tax on any of that dope under state laws that exempt prescribed medicines. Yes. $51 million in four years? It's like the Bass Pro Shops of pot dispensaries. This place must be like the Astrodome. Anyway, that's a lot of money. State tax regulators disagree that the medical marijuana dispensaries are exempt from sales tax, and they have slapped the dispensary with a bill for nearly $6.5 million in back taxes and interest. Yeah. So one Berkeley-based lobbyist here comments in the article. She represents, he or she, I don't even know who this person is. Anyway, this lobbyist represented the dope dealers before the state tax board, and said that it was murky regulations that were to blame for all the confusion surrounding the tax status of prescribed, you know, medicine, dude. This lobbyist said, "We do feel that medical cannabis is medicine. Absolutely, dude. We're realists, though. I mean, we understand that there's a lot of tax revenue at stake. And I know the cities and states, they want revenue. And was I talking about a steak? Because I'm kind of hungry, dude. Maybe we could adjourn for a snack." All right. So can we get to the bottom line here? The state tax board chairman there in California, he said that he wants a new licensing process for all the dope dealers, medicine dispensers out in California. He said licensing would bring pot under the same tight control as cigarettes and liquor in the great state of California. And, of course, we all know how good liquor and cigarettes are for a society. I mean, we know how well that works out. So now let's bring in the clowns with their medical marijuana. Anyway, it reminds me how the politicians out in California have been looking for ways to fix their budget problems. And one of the ways is to legalize and tax marijuana. And, I just think that in very short order that they'll hit the point of diminishing returns when their state labor force is too stoned to get anything done and their engineers are too buzzed to figure out an equation this way or that. And everybody ends up moving to Ohio. Ohio? Maybe. Who knows? All right. Let's dip more into the culture file. You may have to hose yourself off after dipping into this story. This is from the Washington Times. American combat troops will get what, up-armored Humvees? What? No? New rifles? No. American combat troops will get sensitivity training directly on the battlefield about the military's new policy on homosexuals. And the military leaders there say that it makes sense to train our troops while they're on the battlefield so they don't have to return home and do the training then. So the senior enlisted man in Afghanistan, Command Sergeant Major Marvin Hill, he says we're going to get these troops sensitized while they're firing on the Taliban and dodging improvised explosive devices. They're going to get how to talk to a queer without offending him type training. So the Pentagon, according to the Washington Times, is launching an extensive force-wide program to ease the process of integrating open homosexuals into the ranks, including into close-knit fighting units. Yeah, I know. Well, what are you going to do? This is where we are, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, about 30 years ago, someone decided that we were all going to tolerate homosexuality and even celebrate it as a legitimate alternative lifestyle. And we thought that it was really no big deal to just let people be who they want to be and love who they want to love. And now they're on the verge of infecting the military. They've already infected churches, the government, and the institution of marriage. Those are all malignant infections that have been going on for a decade or more. And here they're moving on the military. Let's see here. Again, Command Sergeant Major Marvin. Command Sergeant Major Marvin, this poor guy. I mean, can you imagine getting the orders coming down from the Pentagon? And you know, you're a lifer. What are you going to do? You just carry out your orders. So Command Sergeant Major Marvin's just sitting there scratching his head. And I have a feeling that Command Sergeant Major Marvin Hill over there in Afghanistan, he probably has a plan to implement this open homosexual sensitivity training. And it'll probably consist of less than a 5-minute course. And the Command Sergeant Major will come out and he'll say, "Look, you don't have to kiss them, but don't beat them up. There you go. Now get back out there and kill me some Taliban." Anyway. Let's see here. Sergeant Major he said that the sessions on respecting gays' rights will go right down to the forward operating bases where troops fight Taliban militants on a daily basis. He said, quote, "We're going to execute that training on the ground. We hope that it will have little impact on their combat and security operations here. Hence, we've cut it down to the two lines. You don't have to kiss them, you don't have to dance with them, you don't have to marry them, but don't go beating them up." And that'll be the extent of the training, I hope. I mean, I hope Sergeant Major Marvin is, but I hope he's one of us, for crying out loud. I hope he's not one of them. All right. More? Oh, I've got more on the homosexual front. They always seem to rear their ugly head on a weekly basis. And you know why that is? Is because they see that this is their time. This is their time to achieve political and social power unmatched since the flagging days of the Roman Empire. And they are not gonna go quietly. So here's what we have this week from the New York Times, the venerable old gray lady from New York, from Washington, D.C. "President Obama has determined that the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional, and he's directed the Justice Department to stop defending the law in court. President Obama has decided it's unconstitutional, and after all, he is a constitutional scholar, and so he's just made the determination for us that defending traditional marriage in court is unconstitutional and counterproductive and generally works against his worldview, you might say. Let's see. Mr. Obama, according to this article, opposes same-sex marriage, but he has said repeatedly that his views are evolving. They're beginning to grow gills, and they're losing their tail. The administration's move seems likely to intensify the long-running cultural clash over same-sex marriage." Now, that's how the New York Times puts it. And, folks, the way the New York Times phrases this debate proves that we, the normal people, have already lost the argument. Because the New York Times points out that we now have a long-running cultural clash over same-sex marriage. I have a long-running cultural dispute with same-sex sex and everything that goes with it. But we've lost that argument because, I don't know, someone decided we were going to tolerate deviant, destructive behavior that leads to disease and death. And so now we're going to argue about how we should set up the marriage licenses for the deviants. And so now that's the debate. And I'm sure there are a lot of alleged conservative organizations out there fundraising on this effort to stop gay marriage. These are the same people who told us 20 years ago that homosexuals should have civil rights, but not special rights. Equal rights, but not special rights. And now they're standing up and they're drawing a line in the sand. And they're going to say, we're going to fundraise to here, and this is where we draw the line. And they're going to fundraise a billion or so, and they'll fight. And then when they lose the homosexual marriage, they're going to draw the line at, I don't know, where do you draw the line after that? Bestiality. We're going to draw the line at bestiality. We're going to start sending out the fundraising letters tomorrow. Anyway, it's a sign of an army in retreat. The culture war was lost quite some time ago. All right. Now, what am I? Oh, here we go. An executive director for the American Civil Liberties Union, one Anthony D. Romero, he says, what does he have to say? Do I even care what he has to say? Here's what Anthony Romero, the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, has to say. Quote, "This is a great step by the Obama administration and a tipping point for the gay rights movement that will have ripple effects." Did I say ripple effects? I did. "Ripple effects in contexts beyond the Defense of Marriage Act. It will reach into issues of employment, discrimination, family recognition, and full equality rights for lesbian and gay people." I'm glad that's over. Now we can focus on molesting children. I know it seems radical now, but give us some time. You'll get used to it. Just lay back and enjoy it, dear. You're the one who sets the bar. The hairdo king, the fashions are. You're fabulous.
I'm fabulous.
You're fabulous.
Oh, I'm fabulous.
You're the one we all can see. It's all about you.
It's all about me.
You're fabulous.
I'm fabulous.
You're fabulous.
I'm fabulous.
And I'm back. Wow, that's an interesting bump you found there. Where did you dig something like that up? Sounds like it came right off the Soul Train. Now, not to imply, because don't get me wrong, the Soul Train was one of the most heterosexual broadcasts in the history of all television. But anyway, the beat, and I don't know. Anyway, let's move on. Let's get out of the degradation file, the homosexual degradation of the culture. Let's move out of that file. Into the personhood file, see if we can find some encouraging news. From New York, this is an AP Wire story. An outdoor advertising company has taken down an anti-abortion billboard that pictured a black girl along with the tagline, quote, "The most dangerous place for an African American is in the womb," unquote. That's powerful. That is a powerful billboard. I'm just visualize that in your mind. Now, some residents, according to the article, had said they found the billboard offensive, and members of the black community were especially outraged by it, as well they should be, since they're the ones being killed. But they don't seem to see that. They want the billboard taken down because it reminds them of a very uncomfortable truth, that the black community in America has allowed elitist East Coast whites to slaughter a third or more of their numbers in the past 40 years under the guise of freedom of choice. See, the whites have chosen to kill a lot of the blacks, and the blacks have given them that freedom of choice. And this billboard, just brilliant. Let's see, who hung this billboard up? Well, let's just read along here. The Reverend Al Sharpton has stepped into the fray, not surprisingly, and he's praised the decision by the advertising company and canceled plans to protest the billboard. He was going to go protest that billboard that pointed out his hypocrisy. So that would have been appropriate, I think, for Al to go protest that billboard, because that billboard really points a finger right at Al Sharpton. Anyway, the civil rights activist, that's what the AP calls Al Sharpton, the civil rights activist said the billboard, quote, "depicts black women in a very unfair way," unquote. That's according to Al. I'm sure that black women and the way they're treated at the various abortion mills around the country as their children in the next generation are butchered by liberal white elitists, I'm sure he feels that those women are being treated and depicted in a very fair way. Now, the billboard was placed in the busy Soho neighborhood of Manhattan by the group Life Always as part of a national campaign tied to Black History Month. The group said its message highlights Planned Parenthood's, quote, "targeting of minority neighborhoods," unquote. I don't know about you, but if you look around your metro area, you'll find out that the Planned Parenthood, which is the largest child-killing organization in the world, Planned Parenthood, they're always located in the black section of town. They're usually just off Martin Luther King Boulevard. At least that's the way it is here in the Denver metro area. Planned Parenthood has called the billboard campaign, this particular ad, quote, "a condescending effort to stigmatize and shame African-American women." I don't know where they get that. This is obviously an effort to stigmatize and shame Planned Parenthood, who is killing millions of black children every year. Maybe not millions, hundreds of thousands of black children every year. Planned Parenthood butchers black children, and this ad seems to have been an effort to stigmatize and shame them, but oddly enough, Planned Parenthood has taken the exact opposite tack on that. Now, Sharpton, he said he was open to discussing the subject of abortion in the black community and did not dismiss it as an issue outright, but he called instead for a sober analysis of the situation and said he would call a community meeting to address this issue publicly. So Al Sharpton is going to lead the fight, lead the African-American community out of the wilderness of slaughtering their own children by organizing a community meeting to address the issue publicly. And he says that the way you address abortion is, quote, "not by demonizing black women,"
That's not how you address abortion, by demonizing black women.
Well, Al, you're the only one here who thinks any black women were demonized. The ad obviously demonized those who butcher the children of mostly poor inner-city black women. One final note on this story. In December of 2010, New York City's health department released statistics showing 41% of pregnancies in that city were aborted in 2009, and the rate was close to 60% for African Americans. And that's the truth of it, Reverend Al. You're supposedly a leader in the black community, you and Jesse Jackson and who else? Are there any other hustlers that are currently have clawed their way to the top of the civil rights racket? I can think of Sharpton. I can think of Jesse Jackson. I just can't think of any others off the top of my head. Nation of Islam, what's his name? Farrakhan? I don't know if he counts. Anyway, it's under your leadership that a third or more of your community has been killed by white people. I would say you're not a successful black leader if you allow the children of your followers to be butchered by the man. I think it's time for Reverend Al to resign or maybe go to divinity school or actually start a real church. Well, no, I guess we don't want Al Sharpton starting a church. I mean, unless he has a major change of heart, that would probably be negative. All right, let's move on further into the personhood file. This is from Richmond, Virginia, from the Associated Press. Virginia approved a bill that would likely make rules so strict that abortion mills would be forced to close. Virtually every abortion mill in Virginia. They say Virginia will become the first state to require clinics that provide first trimester abortions to meet the same standards as hospitals. Okay. Democrats and abortion rights supporters said the change would put an estimated 17 of the 21 clinics in Virginia out of business. Most of the clinics provide birth control, cancer screenings, and women health services, in addition to butchering, burning, and ripping babies apart, shredding their bodies, and killing them. They also offer cancer screening. So yes, we do butcher and tear children apart and then market their body parts to various scientific endeavors, but we also do cancer screenings here as well. And women's health services. Yeah. Okay. So here we have a Republican, Senator Jill Vogel, a state senator there in Virginia. She says, "This is not about banning abortions. It's simply caring for women who are about to have an invasive surgical procedure and creating an environment for them where they have the opportunity to do that in a place that is safe." Unquote. Okay, Jill. Could we sit down for a second? Eye to eye. Let's have a little heart to heart, Jill. You don't introduce a bill whose goal is to ban abortion. You don't introduce that bill by prefacing it by saying, "This is not about banning abortions." Because, Jill, that makes your pro-life base, it makes us wonder whose side. What do you mean it's not about banning abortions? Isn't that what the pro-life argument is about? It's about stopping the killing of innocent people. And she prefaces her statement by saying, "This is not about banning abortions. Just move along. There's nothing to see here. We're not trying to ban abortions. We're just trying to make sure that the facilities in which the children are butchered are clean and that the women don't get ancillary infections." Jill, just come out and say it's about banning abortions. We of the pro-life attitude, we would have a lot more respect for you. Anyway, let's see. We have a Democrat here. Can the Democrat outdo the Republican for stupidity and vacuity? Let's see. Democratic Senator Mamie Locke from Hampton. She says, quote, "Does Virginia really want to take the lead in such obstruction?" As she called the bill a draconian and patriarchal effort at best. Democrats argued it wouldn't pass constitutional muster because it would put an undue burden on poor women. Again, poor women, right? Those are the kids that we're killing are of these poor women. And don't we all agree that poor women are undesirable? say the liberal elitist whites as they look around the room. And they look around, they say, look, we're killing these undesirable, poor, mostly black women. Yeah, yeah. You guys have a problem with that? See, the liberal elitists thought that we were all on their side because we're all white. I mean, the pro-life movement, I'm sorry, it is lily white. Although I was encouraged by the pastor down at Berean Bible Church last Saturday. Had an opportunity to view a film that documents Planned Parenthood's undisputed effort to eliminate undesirable black people, who I believe they dubbed them as feeble-minded, and that basically set them up for the slaughter. Anyway, it's undeniable. The movie's called Ma'afa 21, M-A-A-F-A 21. Go online, check it out. It will blow your mind. If you think that the pro-lifers are just crazy because we go around saying that Planned Parenthood has targeted black people, well, it's all documented. It's undeniable. They wrote it to themselves. They wrote it back and forth in letters and, you know, letters from Goebbels to the birth control review. I mean, it's all there documented, folks. Check that movie out. Let's see. I like this. This Democrat, Democrats who argue that clinics likely would close, they argue that it would violate the equal protection guarantee of the Constitution by treating abortions differently than similar procedures. Now, what medical procedures are similar to abortion? Can you think of any? What other medical procedures involve the affirmative killing of a human being? Let's all think together, class. Are there any other similar medical procedures where the object is to kill one of the patients? I just can't think of any, but then again, I'm not a doctor. Let's see. We have another Democrat to quote here. Senator Mary Margaret Whipple, a Democrat from Arlington, Virginia, says absolutely all that will be accomplished by this vote is to restrict access to a safe and legal procedure to poor women. Can't you see I'm standing up for the poor women? As her jaws are clenched and the muscles are... You can see the muscle fibers in her cheek. As she grits her teeth and talks about protecting poor women as she reflects on her own abortion that she had. Hey, Margaret, Mary Margaret, have you read Margaret Sanger's book? Don't you understand, Mary Margaret, that it's these poor women that are most in need of killing? Haven't you read Margaret Sanger's book? You need to educate yourself, Mary Margaret. All right. That was sarcasm, by the way. All right. Now, okay. Now that issue gets me a little riled up. It always astonishes me. The stupidity of the masses is astonishing. That white female Democrats can stand up with a straight face and tell a large group of inner city black people that we're looking out for your health and your welfare while they support an organization that has butchered almost 60% of blacks in some New York City neighborhoods. How can you people be so stupid and gullible? Maybe it's that, well, I don't even know if I want to go there. Maybe it's that what the people want is abortion. That's what those communities want. Could that be? Could it be that we, the people, want the ability to have unrestrained sex with whoever we want and then we want to dispose of the evidence? Could it be that that's who we are? I'm afraid that could be the case. I think that a rational clinical analysis of the state of denial of the majority of people in this country indicates that is what America is now. It's a nation where the older and richer people want to keep what they have at the expense of the next generation, even to the point of killing that next generation. That's scary to think that that's what we've become. I certainly hope it's not the case, but I can't think of any other explanation as to why people buy a lie like that, except that that's really what they want. That's scary. I mean, it's like a dementia, suicidal, schizophrenic. I don't know what's going on. That's not any America I want to live in. And if this union is to be preserved, there's going to have to be an end to this killing of innocent people. It's simply going to have to end because the moral minority is not going to tolerate this forever. Because there are a minority of us in this country who are willing to stand up and sacrifice for the lives of innocent people, lives that are being threatened by the majority, the stronger majority. All right, let's move into the war file. Let's go to Lubbock, Texas. Khalid Ali al-Dawsari has appeared in the U.S. federal court in Lubbock, Texas last Friday, and he has retained an attorney named Rod. So Ali al-Dawsari, he faces a maximum penalty of life in prison. He bought explosive chemicals online and planned to blow up dams, nuclear power plants, or the Dallas home of former President George W. Bush. And he faces a maximum penalty of life in prison. This is why we are going to lose to the Muslims if something radical doesn't change. When you catch a guy who's going to blow up your former president or a nuclear power plant or a dam, the trial must be quick and the execution must be swift, painful, and public so that all the other Ali al-Masawadaris who are contemplating such acts understand that that there's a price to be paid. And I know, well, they're all suicidal and they want to meet Allah, right? Yeah, well, most of them talk a good game. But a good, swift, public, painful execution will change a lot of Ali Ali's minds. Yeah. What else do we have on Ali? In his journal, the college student from Saudi Arabia who studied chemical engineering in Texas described a plan to travel to New York City and place bombs in several rental cars for remote detonation and leave the vehicles in different places during rush hour. He also wrote in his journal, "It is time for jihad." That's in the journal they recovered. It's time for jihad. So do you think there's others out there like Ali M. al-Dawsari? Do you think there's others? And even bigger question, who poses more of a threat to you and your family? Ali al-Dawsari or the followers of Margaret Sanger who have butchered nearly 60% of the black kids in some New York City neighborhoods? Who's a more clear and present danger, America? You be the judge. Stevie, put that guitar away. Put that guitar away. We're almost out of time. I needed that, folks. I apologize. I have to calm myself down sometimes. And a little bit of Stevie Ray Vaughan go a long way to doing it, my friend. I tell you what. All right, let's move on. While the Muslim terrorists are sneaking across the Texas border and the descendants of Margaret Sanger are committing genocide in New York City, here's what the president, the leader of the free world, has been up to this week. The White House, according to the Washington Post, made history last Friday. It announced Jeremy Bernard as its new social secretary. Why is this news? Why would anyone care? Well, he's the first man to hold that post. So let's give a round of applause that the glass ceiling of party planning has finally been shattered by a man. And his name is Jeremy Bernard. Oh, he's also the first openly gay person to fill the role of social secretary at the White House. So, well, I guess I guess, fellas, we haven't cracked that glass ceiling yet because Jeremy's, let's just say he's not a man's man. Well, maybe you could say he is a man's man.
Oh.
That's just terrible. Anyway, so while the entire world shakes and burns and is on the brink of chaos and revolution, Barack Obama is putting a fairy in as his social secretary. Bernard, who is currently the senior advisor to the ambassador at the U.S. Embassy in Paris, will replace Juliana Schmoot, who was the social secretary, and because she wasn't a homosexual or some other kind of deviant freak, she was never appropriately celebrated in the news media, but Mr. Bernard's name will be ballyhooed from sea to shining sea. Can't wait to see the interview on Anderson Cooper. Let's see. The White House released a statement on their new social secretary, and here's how it goes. Jeremy shares our vision for the White House as the people's house, one that celebrates our history, our culture, in dynamic and inclusive ways. We look forward to Jeremy continuing to showcase America's art and culture to our nation and the world through the many events at the White House. Thank you very much. Unquote. That's the White House's statement. I don't want to imply that the White House is gay and talks with a lisp, but, you got to wonder at this point. Let's see. Bernard previously worked as the White House liaison to the National Endowment for the Humanities and was also a member of the Democratic National Committee. Talk about a guy who's just on the highway to hell. I mean, just an open homosexual, works for the National Endowment for the Humanities, a member of the DNC. I mean, it's going to be straight to hell with jet rockets for this guy. Golly. Anything more here? Bernard, who has been active in gay rights organizations, was a prominent fundraiser for the Obama campaign in California. His selection marked a second decision by Obama this week that has delighted gay activists, and they're so easily delighted. Obama chose Bernard only 2 days after the administration announced it would abandon the Defense of Marriage Act, the federal law that bans homosexual marriage. Let's see. Fred Saints, who's a spokesman for the Human Rights Campaign, emphasized that Bernard's qualifications and not his sexual orientation were what should be highlighted. But then he added, "Well, you just can't help notice the significance of it, though, can you? It's just so exciting. It's just wonderful." No, it's, of course, he was a very qualified person. Did you hear that he's gay? All right. So that's what the leader of the free world is up to. So New Zealand. I mean, this is awful. So, I mean, last week, the national Christmas tree was snapped in half by a microburst up in Washington, D.C., and this week, Christchurch in New Zealand is devastated for a second time by a massive earthquake. I'll tell you, if I was superstitious, I would start to wonder if maybe God is trying to send us a message. But I'm not superstitious, and I feel terrible for these poor people down in New Zealand. It's just an awful tragedy. All right, so let's keep the people of New Zealand in our prayers. Let's keep Christchurch in our prayers, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Now, on from the French press agency, leaked diplomatic cables vividly show China's willingness to translate its massive holdings of U.S. debt into political influence on issues ranging from Taiwan's sovereignty to Washington's alleged financial policy. Sensitive cables that came out through the WikiLeaks fiasco show just how much influence Beijing has and how keen Washington is to address its rivals' concerns. Amid the panic of Lehman Brothers' collapse and the ensuing liquidity crunch, you all remember that, back in 08? Well, while that was all going on, Liu Zhihua, an official who then helped manage China's foreign reserves, was, quote, noncommittal on the possible resumption of lending. So when everything was hitting the fan back there in 08, the Chinese, they said, well, we might be able to loan you some money, maybe. We're not going to make a commitment. I'm not sure what that means. But it sounds like you're not saying you're just going to write us a check here. Is there something we could do to help you, maybe, Mr. Liu, that would, you know, help you to have a little better attitude about buying our bonds. What could we do?
In that regard, the recent announcement that the United States intend to send another arm package to Taiwan has increased the difficulty the Chinese government faces in explaining any support policies to the Chinese public. You know what I mean? No tiki no washi. Yeah, Mr. Washington, D.C.
Anyway, so the Pentagon was about to sell $6.5 billion worth of arms to Taiwan, and the much-delayed package, according to the article, was eventually sold, but did not include the requested F-16 jets. And everyone knows if you're out to buy a large package of weapons for your military, the last thing you want to leave out is the F-16s. They're like the best part. Anyway, all right, I'm running out of time. How does this happen to me? Every week I'm running out of time. Let's go through this quick on the economy, folks. We're all participating in the Obama recovery. Home prices in a majority of major U.S. cities have fallen to their lowest levels since the housing bubble burst back in 06, 07, 08, and 09, 10, and 11. The only market to see gains in housing prices was, can you guess? Washington, D.C., where the ruling class lives. They're not suffering. And neither are we. We're all just ebullient in our celebration of the Obama recovery. What do we have here? From Chicago, the Reuters Wire, Walmart stores posted its seventh consecutive quarterly drop in sales at existing U.S. stores. But folks, just move on. I believe there is a NASCAR race or a basketball game for you to watch. Please don't pay any attention to any of this. There's nothing to see here. Dateline Providence, Rhode Island. The Providence, Rhode Island School District sent out dismissal notices to every one of its nearly 2,000 teachers because they might have to close their school system because they're broke. Anyway, I guess we could call this a step in the right direction. If there's one thing I'm for, it's for shutting down the public's, the government school factories. But the fact is, this is happening because, it's similar here in Michigan. I got a story here from the Detroit News. State education officials have ordered implementation of a financial restructuring plan that balances the district books by closing half of its schools. Half of their schools. Yeah. Now, the question is, can American society withstand the economic pressure that is about to be applied upon it? And I do believe that 2011 will be the year we find an answer to that question, because the pressure is going to be unavoidable. And it should be interesting to watch, but not necessarily pleasant. All right. Now, let's move into the vanity file. A resolution was brought up at the DNC's Resolutions Committee, as you can well imagine, if you have a Resolutions Committee, likely resolutions are going to be brought to the fore. Well, a resolution commemorating Nancy Pelosi's years as Speaker of the House made its way in front of the distinguished group of ruling class elders there at the DNC Resolutions Committee. And Pelosi's daughter sought to alter the proposal at her mother's behest, adding some of the accomplishments that Ms. Pelosi felt the committee had overlooked. First, Pelosi wanted to add a mention of her fight against HIV and AIDS because she says it was, quote, why she went to Congress, unquote. Then, Nancy wanted to insert a paragraph on her accomplishments for equality, mentioning the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act of 2009 and the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Seek, Don't Smell policy that we all remember. Finally, since, as she said, I'm not going anywhere, you remember Nancy Pelosi said, I'm not going anywhere, she wanted to add in the final whereas clause, and we'll continue the fight for America's working families. That's according to Christine Pelosi, no relation to Nancy, except that it's her daughter. Wow. Okay. So they added all these amendments to bring to light all the accomplishments of the glorious reign of Nancy Pelosi, at which point the Mad Hatter leapt out of a mirror and led them all down a rabbit hole where they dined on mushrooms and the body of Grace Slick. I don't know where I was going with that. I wasn't sure how to end that. It was just so ridiculous. All right. Now, let's see here. We just a little bit more. We're going to go just a little long, but you all should be used to that by now. Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin. What's going on in Madison, Wisconsin? I've been trying to ignore it because the story just strikes me as so stupid that I just don't want to give it any coverage at all. But I guess now that violence is probably going to break out, I suppose I need to cover this. Republicans at the Wisconsin Assembly took the first significant action in their plan to strip collective bargaining rights from most public workers, abruptly passing the measure early last Friday morning before sleep-deprived Democrats realized what was happening. Sleep-deprived, you can read that, hungover Democrats, before they realized what was going on. The Assembly's vote sent the bill on to the Senate, but minority Democrats in the House have fled to Illinois to prevent a vote. So the Democrats have fled to Illinois to prevent a vote. You could read prevent a vote. You could just put in eat, drink, and be merry. Yeah. I don't know. I think Barry Ho has a safe house in Chicago for disaffected Democrats. And they all run down there. And I don't know. They're like partying with Charlie Sheen or something down there. It's bizarre. How can they be allowed to do that? I don't understand that. Anyway, so did I say that violence was going to erupt in Wisconsin? I have no way to know if that's true, but certainly unions have never engaged in any kind of violent tactics. That could never happen. I'm sure that'll all end just fine. Let's move on now to the politics file from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the city of brotherly love. From CBS, two children were killed in a fire in the city's only section last Tuesday. The engine that would have been the first on the scene, engine 61, was browned out. Browned out, I said. It was closed for the day as a part of the city's cost-cutting measures out there in Philadelphia. Meanwhile, while engine 61 was shut down and the children were being burned alive, meanwhile, no-show union jobs and patronage jobs in the bureaucracy have not been cut, but they've shut down Engine 61, and in my opinion, an investigation should ensue because these people may have blood on their hands. All right. Tripoli, Libya, embattled Libyan president or king or whatever he is, Muammar Gaddafi, passed out guns to civilian supporters, set up checkpoints, and sent armed patrols roving and terrorizing the capital, trying to maintain control over Gaddafi's stronghold. Armed men in green armbands, along with uniformed security forces, checked those trying to enter the district, where graffiti is scrawled on the walls, and it says, "Gaddafi, you Jew." What? "Gaddafi, you Jew?" I didn't think there was any anti-Semitic types involved in this beautiful democratic jasmine revolution that's sweeping the Muslim world. But don't worry, folks. The Unsecurity Council began deliberations to consider an arms embargo against the Libyan government. So they're considering an arms embargo while Gaddafi is handing out guns to his maniacal jackbooted thugs. It's good to see that the UN is on the case. All right, now we've got one more. Oh, from the Nation of Islam. When thousands of followers met in suburban Chicago this past weekend for the Nation of Islam's convention, one of the main events was a panel of scientists discussing worldwide UFO sightings, which they claim are on the rise. Nation of Islam leader Elijah Muhammad, you'll remember, had detailed in speeches and writings a massive hovering object loaded with weapons that he called the mother plane. Yeah. Now, the folks of the Nation of Islam say this is one of the group's most misunderstood and ridiculed beliefs. We have a quote from Ismail Mohammed, the religion's national assistant minister. He said to the Associated Press, "Listen here, man. There have been enough accounts and sightings and enough movies and documentary made about these UFOs. I don't think you find too many people that think it's all that crazy." Unquote. And I think that's where we'll leave it this week, folks. I want to thank you for being with me. I want to thank KGOV. Personage USA, American Rights of Life, and of course, as always, my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. I'll be back with you next week, should the Lord tarry. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.